Bandwidth for the Weird Things podcast provided by WiredTree. For sites of any size and world-class customer service, head on over to WiredTree.com.
Welcome to the Weird Things podcast. I'm Andrew Main, joined by Brian Brushwood, who's sitting in a car right now.
I mean, you could say it's a car, but for all you know, maybe it's a helicopter. Maybe it's a helicopter that's very close to the ground right now in a parking lot. I mean, I'm not going to judge.
I like the fact you've also got a lavalier mic on, too, as well as your earbuds.
Okay, yeah, truth be told, I'm inches from walking out on stage. We just mic checked, and I'm doing the Houston Association of Magicians banquet. There's like 400 seats in there, and I'm closing the show. And so I came out, we just did sound check, and I'm ducking out. I'm like, we're good for an hour, right? And so they're doing awards and stuff, and I'm doing the Weird Things podcast.
Dedication. Joining us from Oakland, Justin Robert Young.
Hello, friends. It's me, Justin.
Justin may sound a little bit off here. I think he's, what is that? Is that Zika? What do you got?
I think I do. I think I have the Zika, as the kids are calling it. No, I don't know. All of a sudden, I just got this. Something just hit me, and just a lot of malaise and exhaustion and sleeping and just insane. I don't know.
You just described my life.
Yeah, a lot of dizziness. You know, I've written 3 books about a female magician solving crime. So
side effects.
He's got Andromania. It's official.
Yeah.
Well, I'm gonna do my plug up front, folks, because I don't know how many people actually make it all the way to the end of the podcast. I'm super excited because tomorrow is the official launch of my brand new novel, Station Breaker.
Oh, congratulations. That's huge.
I'm super stoked. Station Breaker, if you listen to podcasts that like Weird Things and you hear some of the things we yammer on about reusable rockets, about, you know, the future of space travel and all that, Station Breaker is set in a world very like our own. I didn't put a date. It could be next year. It could be the next couple of years. All the tech in it's real. It's about an astronaut by the name of David Dixon working for this private space company, doing a routine mission to bring an astronaut up to a space station. And they have to do an emergency dock on a Russian space station. And then all hell goes to loose. Gunfights in space, got action chases on Earth. He has to steal just about anything that can move to find out what's going on and stay a step ahead of the people trying to kill him. So it's high-tech adventure. I'm hesitant to call it sci-fi because it's more in the Tom Clancy sort of vein. And everything in there for listeners or a podcast, it's very familiar technology. It's not – there's no teleporters or, you know, super AI or anything like that.
Safe to say that this is the most Weird Things story that you've written, right?
I would say so. I think that's a very good assessment. I think that it's we like to talk about, for the most part, tech that's kind of near term. And it's just if you're – we and our listeners were kind of ahead of the curve in that we knew what was happening with SpaceX. We knew that was a big deal before everybody else did because we talk about it ad nauseum. But we understand the economics of that. We have a pretty good picture, I think, of what the world could be like. And so that's what I wanted to do is sort of set a story in, you know, what the next 10 years could be like. And it's you just have the assumption that, hey, we've got reusable rockets, we're building space station, and what's it like from there? It's hard sci-fi, it's not aliens or anything like that. It's just more action espionage.
And at the same time, there's a lot of, if you enjoyed Public Enemy Zero, there are certainly echoes there. I think it's also the most Public Enemy Zero-esque type of book that you've written, which is great because it's a return to a genre that you do very, very well. And I'm sure everybody that's enjoyed that book would probably say the same. This has similar ideas, but taken in a totally different direction because of the world that it's set in. So, you know, survival, conspiracy, action, adventure, science, it's all there.
Yeah, it's the first of a series, my space ops series. The second book's already written, will be coming out actually within months. Yeah, just more of a matter of, you know, getting a polish on that. So I want to keep putting things out on the story. I'm going to try to. I'm launching it right now for this week. It'll be 99 cents. You can get the ebook for just 99 cents. Official launch is tomorrow. Anybody who's listening to it right now, if you could hold off till tomorrow to try to push, that's fine. But if you got to have it, I understand. I launched it a few days ago on, and I mentioned on my email list because I was trying to say, hey, anybody who's read it, if you want to put up a review, please do so. Enough people went out to go buy it, even though I wasn't trying to push it, that it put it into the top 100 techno thrillers.
So, oh, wow. Fantastic.
But that was kind of like – but I was trying to avoid what happened with not there now, but that was when I did the launch. I was trying to avoid what happened when I launched Game Night, where I launched Game Night on this podcast, but it wasn't ranking on Amazon. And I sold enough copies of that in one day that it would have been in like the top 10 in its category, but Amazon wasn't tracking.
Oh, no.
Because it was pre-sale, right?
No, it wasn't pre-sale. It's just like you can have a book goes live, let's say at midnight or when a book goes live, it might be 24 hours after it goes live before they start counting the sales.
Oh, yeah.
Got it.
So here's the deal.
My plan was to avoid that this time. But I figure with our podcast audience, people listen throughout the week and over time that it's fine. We're listening to this now. You know, if it's not Sunday, not live, go buy it, please. 99 cents. And yeah. That's all I got to say. That's my plug.
But also, if you could wait till Monday, you know, be nice.
Yeah. We're going to try to see how far we can push it. I'm going to be shameless in my promotion of it. And we'll see what it is. I'll be doing a lot of live streaming this week and answering writers' questions, things like that, talking about science. So pay attention to my Twitter.
Dude, this is so exciting. It's really, I think, what, you know, the story is one of your best. And this release, I think, is super exciting, not only for me, your friend, but also all of your fans. You know, this is exactly what people want out of you and your talents, that not only can they go get this book and it's at a price that's super rad, but also, you know, the sequel's only months away. It's not years away, right?
So yeah, I'm already writing the third one. So and it's going to keep building on the idea of what space is going to be like in the next decade or so. The first several books are just all about low Earth orbit and kind of the exciting world that is. Speaking of exciting things in space, gentlemen, I watched a presentation.
Name one thing that's exciting in space.
Yes, exciting in space. There was a presentation that came up on NASA 360, and it was a video presentation from a few months ago at a conference. NASA has this project for, like, they give funding to some very interesting areas of research, and this was a NASA researcher talking about his project, and it's a real thing, not a maybe real thing, like EM drive or whatever. It's based on existing technology, and I did not realize in the last 5 years how this became much more of a reality based upon developments we've made with fiber optics, etc. And what I'm talking about is photonic propulsion, the idea of using a beam of light, particularly a laser beam, to project energy, to shoot a beam of light against something that collects it or a mirror that reflects it off and uses that radiative pressure. There is – light gives off pressure. It's very, very small kinds of pressure, but there is pressure that it gives off. There's – you know, you've seen those little globes where they spin around, you put it in for a light. There are two kinds. There's one that does not use radiative pressure, that's actually just the little gas molecules kicking off. But there's another kind that actually can measure that pressure. When we send space probes and things out into space, we have to account for the amount of pressure the sun pushes on these objects, that the little photons striking and how much energy they impact. But you can use a laser beam to push an object. Now, the problem is you get, if you have a laser beam that has a small point right now, by the time that it gets thousands of miles out, that beam starts to get very wide and very inefficient, which is why, although we thought about, hey, it'd be great to be able to use lasers to push objects, you get that divergence. Well, we've developed in the last few years, we've developed what's called phased arrays, phased array antennas, phased array lasers, which allow you to control that divergence much more and to have that beam not get really wide. And so, you know, imagine a flashlight and you're trying to use all that energy from the flashlight hitting a small object. Well, the further away the object gets, the bigger the light cone. But with phased arrays, you can narrow that cone down considerably and send it further out. So what does this mean if you have a photonic laser propulsion system where you'd have some stationary thing, maybe an orbit around Earth, projecting its energy onto an object. You can continuously put out energy onto it and keep pushing it and keep pushing it. How fast would it move something? You ready for this?
Uh-huh.
Yeah, ready.
How about a kilogram to Mars in 8 hours?
Hold on. It seems like acceleration would be problematic in that regard. How many G's is that pulling to get up to there?
Well, Brian, we're not going to worry about how many G's right now. Really freaking fast. So maybe you want to ramp that up. But my point is when you're worried about that, that's a good problem. Because you could go slower if you want, Brian. Brian wants it slower, guys. Brian wants it slower.
I do. Well, and specific. So help me understand. This is I know we've talked about the idea of solar sails. Mm-hmm. You know, riding the solar winds and stuff. How is this different from that? This is a case where it's receiving the energy and what is it? What is it shooting out behind it in order to go fast?
It's effectively a solar sail, but instead of using the sun's energy, you're using a directed laser beam.
Got it. Got it, man. So, that's huge.
Yeah.
And this guy has a working prototype or some kind of.
They've in the lab. There's been a lot of tests in the lab. They've been able to demonstrate pressure on a CubeSat. So you could send 1 kilogram to Mars in 8 hours. You could send 100 kilogram using, again, the power on this is tremendous. It's like 100 gigawatts, which is, you know, you need a bunch of power stations to make this thing work. But you could send 100 kilogram robotic craft. So that's 200 pounds to Mars in 3 days. Okay. Now there's a kind of spacecraft called wafer craft, which is the idea that if you put all the little sensors down on a tiny little chip wafer, you know, we should be using those to explore further out because you can send a bunch of them out there. You could send a little wafer 30% the velocity of light.
Oh, wow, that's fast.
So you're at Alpha Centauri in a little over a decade.
So, okay, do we have to worry about, based on the nature of this firing mechanism or whatever, you're saying that distance is no object because you're not...
No, distance is not... There is... You start over time... You lose efficiency, but using the conventional technology we have now, this is what we could do. Now there are other forms of this technology that talk about like recycling photons, or if you could bounce them back and forth between two mirrors, you get an order of magnitude more power. But that's problematic. We don't really know how to do that over vast distances. But just using one beam shooting this for as long as it has, there's proposals for a photonic railroad, which would be that you would have these transmitters, these emitters stationed throughout our solar system so that you could have a payload once it gets out of range of something else. But it's still got all that velocity. It could hit something else, could start projecting it. So there's a cool video if you do, we'll put it up on the links there where you can watch his presentation on it and he shows some examples of how something like this could work. Now, to make this practical, you'd have to build a power station in orbit that's like 100 times the size of the International Space Station. But
I mean, which is not from an engineering standpoint impossible, right?
Correct. And that's where we're at. It's an engineering and economics problem. It's not a science problem.
That's crazy.
So is the implied best use of this technology for intra-solar system travel or headed to other stars?
You could use it for intra-solar system travel. It would be you could build a, you know, what he describes as like a shuttle class spacecraft that could get to Mars in a couple weeks. With this, so you have the opportunity. It opens up the solar system tremendously. It really becomes, and you have to figure out like how do you decelerate? How do you deal with these other problems? You know, are you going to try to do a, you know, shoot something into orbit around something else? But its implications are tremendous for both cases, and they also has applications as far as deflecting asteroids, eliminating space debris. There's many, many. So the principal research on this, his name is Philip Lubin, Philip Lubin. And it's a very interesting talk to see this, you know. So, I mean, 30% of the speed of light, and I guess inside 10 minutes.
So this presentation.
How much of this was even on our radar coming into, like, an announcement like this? Like, you mentioned that there has always been this idea of using a laser pointer, but this seems like a quantum leap in terms of what we could expect from something.
I think that the big technological leap has been the idea of the phased array. The phased array is using a series of antennas or emitters that actually keep a beam from diverging too much. That's been something that's been used elsewhere, and the application of that here, I think, has been kind of the big deal. You know, the idea that you could all of a sudden say, hey, we now have the capability to we don't need ridiculous amounts of power. I mean, we're not talking planet size. I mean, 100 gigawatts is not an insignificant amount of power, but it's not we need to convert Jupiter into whatever to do this. It's a term of power that we can relate to, that we use, that we create. You know, every day on Earth we create much more than that. So it's a human scale engineering problem now.
So what was the context of the presentation to begin with? Was this like looking for grant money, or this was like a show and tell of NASA?
It was a show and tell for an existing program that NASA runs, where they fund some different areas of research. So that's what it was. He is showing, here's what we've developed so far. This is the state of where we're doing. This is what we're doing next.
Wouldn't it be interesting if now that, you know, SpaceX is handling, and we've talked about this before, you know, like we don't necessarily want or feel the need for the post office to own all of its own fleet of stuff, or to manufacture mm-hmm. its own cars. We want them to handle the general business of moving our mail around. Wouldn't it be great if NASA was able to entirely start focusing on big ideas like this, essentially becoming, you know, a DARPA for getting our meat off of this Petri dish?
100% agree. I think that we're fans of NASA. We seriously are big fans yeah. of NASA. And I had the privilege of going to JPL a week ago and seeing some awesome stuff there. You know, you're in the room looking at a computer that's controlling the Dawn spacecraft, which is orbiting Ceres, a dwarf planet. And you think about the spacecraft's the size of, you know, a moving van, and it's out there. It's a real physical thing, really orbiting something, and that's incredible. And I, all the more of that we can get, versus I'm not a big fan of the SLS project, which is the big, huge, heavy lift booster they're doing, which just uses old technology and is going to be ridiculously expensive. If we could be putting more of that into things like this, oh my God. I mean, Brian, you'd be, it just, it's, that's the NASA I want.
Can we kind of peer into the crystal ball here of, like, you know, SLS has tremendous inertia. I mean, this is a decades out project that, you know, that it's, you know, it's been in the works for decades. It'll probably be going for decades. Is there any stopping it? I mean, is there any way to pivot and say, like, hey, why are we doing this? SpaceX is now offering overnight delivery to the moon. You know, I don't understand.
Well, it comes from a congressional mandate. So enough Congress folk signed on to this and told NASA, you have to build this. We're giving you funding that has to go towards this. So NASA, as it should be, is beholden to Congress, which is beholden to the people. And the problem is that if, you know, for NASA, it means thousands of jobs, that if they said no to this, it's not like they get to use the money for something else. And so they're in a quandary where if they say, no, we'd rather not commit to this. We'd rather not commit $1 billion to this, because 5 years from now, that billion might buy us a lot on a Blue Origin flight or something else. It's just not a practical reality. So I don't know what, you know, the short-term answer is. I think that as other private space companies come up with competing technologies, if SpaceX makes a Falcon Heavy, if SpaceX makes their MCT or their really, really big heavy lift in a shorter time frame, then yeah, it becomes a viable thing. Then you're going to have people going to Congress and saying, much with the Air Force, why are you going to these guys? Why are we doing this when we can go do it cheaper? That's when it happens. But, you know, it's SpaceX, everybody else. Like, SpaceX has a Falcon 9. That's all they've got. I mean, it's amazing, but they don't have – the Falcon Heavy hasn't launched yet. Has not taken off. And we all think that it will. We're all high hopes for it. But until it is a reality.
So, you know what's great about this presentation is it just is a stark reminder that whatever it is, for as much as we are into the, you know, the new, you know, private space race, it just shows that the most significant technology in space travel 10 years from now will be one that's not even on our radar right now. I mean, or barely on our radar. It's gonna be something like this that's in some skunk works and is just gonna show up and revolutionize everything.
Yeah, and there's plenty of fringe stuff too, which may, you know, pan out or not. But even without going to that stuff, the crazy nutty stuff like the EM drive or whatever, this is a real thing. This is known physics, and that's what's exciting, is the idea that you start thinking about literally putting a 2-pound probe on Mars in 8 hours. that you could have a 200 pound spacecraft on there in 3 days. What does that mean? It just
I mean, that's it's absolutely crazy. And ultimately, what's almost more exciting in the here and now is that these ideas catch momentum, that we are so focused on it because these aren't just vaporware in ways that they used to be. You know, these are things that like, oh, wow, no, hey, look, why can't this happen?
Precisely. A lot of interesting technologies out there. I've talked a bit more about fusion. I'm a believer that we are probably going to have a radically big development in fusion very, very shortly. And I, you know, we talk about how, it's always been 20 years away, but it's always been one big government project doing it.
Yeah.
Which,
so do you have a specific technology that's on the fringe right now that you feel like makes you bullish on fusion?
Yeah. I mean, well, what's happened in fusion in the last 5 or 6 years is you've had, the number of companies and people trying to make it happen has just increased dramatically. It used to be the Department of Energy said that, hey, fusion is our baby. We're building our tokamak reactor. If any fusion project went for funding to the United States government that got above some little experimental test thing, they would say, no, you can't do that. It's ours. So you've had one monolithic organization in the United States that's been running it and saying that we're betting on this tokamak thing, that even once it gets up and running, it's not a thing you can drop into a power plant. And that's been problematic. And there's been a brain drain. There's not, you know, there haven't been anybody outside of, you know, basement labs and small workshops working on the problem. We've seen before how, like with the Human Genome Project, how this was a project that, you know, at the onset, we could say, hey, this will be a great thing. Inside there were people like Craig Venter who are like, hey, we've got a faster way. But they're like, well, no, this is the way we're going to do it. And he stepped outside into the world of private capital. And that was a position where 10 years before, there wasn't private capital to support an effort like that. Now, with infusion research, you've got a number of companies. You've got General Fusion, TriAlpha Energy, EM. You've got a few different companies out there that are doing this with really brilliant people trying different strategies. And what they're trying to do is versus, you know, the National Ignition Facility, ITAR, and these other big, huge projects, they're all building these round tokamak reactors or fusion reactors that are experimental, and once they work and once maybe they achieve successful ignition, they then have to build some other thing to figure out how to scale it to work into, you know, our existing power system. What these companies are doing is they have different ways of doing this stuff, different strategies of different designs. They're not doing, you know, the toroidal, as far as I'm concerned, as far as I know, they're using other designs for this. Their goal is, we've achieved small laboratory success. Now we're building these bigger modules. And once these things are done, once our reactor's done, we can drop it into an existing power plant that uses steam driven, and it will power those turbines. They're building something that's ready to scale in 10 years' time, not 30.
Wow.
Internally, I hear, you know, very, you know, a lot of this is very stealth. A lot of this is very under the radar, where people are kind of keeping secret. Internally, I hear we're 3 years away from something happening. That could be, but, you know, that could be BS. Let's tell investors this sort of thing. But there's more capital, more intellectual capital has been spent on this project now in the last 5 years than has been spent, you know, outside of government in the last 50.
Yeah, I hope it's the kind of thing where it really is just a engineering issue where all you need to do is, like you say, put the right amount of human capital towards it. I hope it's, I mean, I don't see any reason that it would be a fundamental issue. You know, it's not like we're hoping to figure out a way to make sand into a energy source or something.
Right.
You know?
No. Yeah. It's, you get into, there's a lot of little hard problems you have to solve, you know, and, you know, putting that much energy into something, not having your coils blow apart or what have you. Now, there's a Bryce has just pulled up. Lockheed is working on their thing, their compact reactor system. They have their own project to develop a fusion reactor. And again, the idea of doing this compact fusion system is that you can then drop them into place into existing power grids, which means, let's say tomorrow somebody comes out and says, yes, we've successfully done this. It puts out more energy than it takes in. They can then, I'll tell you the problem with the Lockheed problem and reactor though in a second. But the problem that what you then have is you could say that realistically we're 10 years out from you plugging something into the wall and having to be powered by fusion. And that changes everything. Your costs, your fuel costs are 1,000% less, you know, a 1,000th rather of what conventional fuels cost. The best, most interesting efforts in fusion, I believe, are what's called the PB11 fusion reactors, where conventional fusion is taking, you know, like isotopes of hydrogen, deuterium, and tritium and fusing those together. But they have a high neutronicity, which means they give off a lot of neutrons when they do that, which means you have to have tons of shielding. Where PB11 uses a proton, and then it uses a isotope of boron, which is makes up 1/3 of all boron atoms. And that has an extremely low level of neutronicity, which means that you could put this into existing power plants and not worrying about making, you know, the radiation it gives off as it's running. So PB11 is a very exciting area of research. This is what Robert Bussard was working on, who was the inventor of the Bussard ramjet, who was a big work for head of Los Alamos, is a pioneering researcher in atomic energy, who spent the last year of his life working on fusion. He sadly died in 2007, but he had been, you know, making some very interesting developments up until he passed away.
Holy cow. Dude, that's the sound of me in over my head at this point. I got nothing in the way of fusion.
Watch Robert Bussard's talk for Google. Robert Bussard, B-U-S-S-A-R-D, Google Talk. And he does a really good overview of state of fusion, why he thinks tokamak reactors are not the way to go. And he was a guy who was an early developer of that. And this, he made this talk about a year before he passed away. He was reached this point where he had a naval contract with his company, and they reached the end of the naval contract. And the problem they had is that they wanted more funding. The DOE would say, no, you know, we're this is our purview, and not to disrespect the DOE, but that it gets into the sort of the way in which government sort of can work, where it just carves out territory and says, we do this, you don't do this. Our best minds have said this is the way it works, and that doesn't capitalize on, you know, the wisdom of the crowds.
So. Yeah. Man, dude, that is astonishing. I wish I had more to offer, but I am out of my depth. But I'll tell you who's not out of their depth is Bryce, how many folks are we up to on the Patreon now?
We are at 436 beautiful patrons.
436 people keeping our program as regular as if you are our very own Metamucil. We cannot thank you guys enough. You guys, in fact, right now, this is exactly the kind of situation where normally, back in the old days, the dark ages, I would have said, like, hey, guys, I got this show. I can't do the Weird Things podcast. And yet, here we are right now, inside the Scamcopter 5000, chatting with you guys about nuclear fusion and sending things to Mars in 8 hours. It's freaking insane.
Very insane. You know what else is insane?
What? Goblins? Goblins?
I don't have a goblin story, but I think this is kind of more scarier than a goblin. Several people sent this to us, and understandably so. Hey, you know what's fun? You know, do you guys like monkeys?
Yeah. Are you kidding? We all love monkeys. Who doesn't love monkeys?
Justin, do you like monkeys?
Yes.
I love monkeys.
He just sign languaged me, saying that he loves monkeys.
Do you know it'd be fun? Like, what if we like gave a monkey like some rum to drink? That'd be kind of fun, right?
Wait, are you talking about drunk monkeys? Are we getting into drunk monkey talk?
Maybe we're getting a drunk monkey. So let's give a little monkey some rum, right? Monkeys would drink. Like, I mean, what's legal age of drinking for a monkey, right?
Okay, now help me out here. If I remember correctly, the studies that I've seen, that these are rats, not monkeys, but like rats who are given the option of drinking ethanol, oftentimes they don't like it at all. They don't do anything to it. They taste it once, they leave it alone, unless those rats are subjected to long-term stress, in which case then they start hitting the sauce. I assume it's the same with monkeys, question mark?
So we've had some mixed stories here where we talked about, let's say, these apes, these gorillas we thought were eating berries that had fermented and were punching photographers and stuff. And then we've heard like, no, that's not true. That's a lie spread by, you know, the lobby of monkey, you know, of monkeys who have, you know, apes with no tails versus monkeys. So we have now here an example of what we think is alcohol-induced monkey behavior. A monkey in Brazil was at a bar, was given some rum, and like, you know, your buddy from high school who has a little bit too much, this monkey.
Oh, wait a minute. I've totally read about this story.
Monkey couldn't hold it. just sent Bryce some video of this, and it's one of those things you read about it, and then you see this, and care to describe what you see here?
Okay. I did not see this video, but we're looking at some kind of bodega. There's a monkey on top of the roof brandishing a gigantic chef's knife. This thing is like the size of a lightsaber in its hand, and it's got it in perfect psycho stabby position, and it's poking this thing. Oh, it's so much better with video. This is amazing.
This is a giant knife. This monkey is brandishing on the roof. It's like one of those photos of, you know, when somebody like the police do a stop and they got the crazy person standing on top of a, you know, a newspaper stand or a garbage can, like, don't come close. This monkey's having a bad one, but he's just not letting go of that knife.
And he's definitely like, he's not making stabbing motions, but he's definitely holding it that ready to jab an eye out if the need arises, going back and forth. What did the monkey get into?
The story is the monkey got into some rum.
How much rum? How much rum does it take for a monkey to suddenly? I mean, and first of all, monkeys, I assume, have a pretty good sense of what a knife is, right?
I, you know, they're tool users. They use termite sticks and, you know, or sticks get termites and stuff. I mean, chimps do. And I think that they have a you know, some understanding of that. I had a friend whose dad was in Vietnam, and they looked, and they're sitting in the building there, and they see this hallway, and they look out there, and they see this monkey walking towards them, and they're like, oh, look, there's the monkey. And they see the monkey's got a grenade in its hand.
Oh, my God. Hey, wait, what happened next?
I think the monkey didn't pull the pin, so that didn't happen. But, you know, you don't want to see anybody with a grenade, much less a monkey. So,
yeah. Man, now all of a sudden I'm thinking about the ethical implications. I mean, beyond the ethical implications of war, what about the ethical implications of involuntary conscription of animals? Like, I know that to clear minefields, sometimes they'll just run 100 sheep across a field and just watch and start detonating all over the place.
Oh, yeah. I think that, you know, there was funny when they were doing the lead up to the new Planet of the Apes movies. I think they made some viral video of a chimpanzee holding a gun and shooting people with a gun.
Yeah, and that's right. Like laughing as it fired an AK-47 or something.
Yeah, and I had somebody who showed this to me, like, oh, did you see this thing? And these monkeys. And I didn't know that it was a viral campaign, but he shows this to me. I'm like, I don't believe it. Like, no, it's real. Check it out. I'm like, this has got to be like some viral campaign for something. It's like, no, it's not. And then you look up and it's, you know, from Rise of the Planet of the Apes.
Well, but there's recently I saw on the Google News. Yeah, by the way, we're looking at it right now. It's footage of them mocking a chimpanzee, and then the chimpanzee grabs the gun and starts firing. Similarly, there was alleged sniper footage of somebody, you know, you hear what sounds like, you know, appropriate language for the region. You see what looks like somebody just bullseyeing a bunch of black figures against a heat infrared screen. And it turns out after the fact that it was just a crude video of somebody playing Call of Duty from 3 years ago. Yeah.
That was, I think it was like the Iranian said that was their, you know, the Hamas target shooters or whatever, taking out ISIS or something like that. News agency reported that as legit.
Well, it's funny because it used to be, it used to be in the 1800s that nobody really believed, and this is all, I don't know, this is what I'm told. Don't believe me. I don't know nothing. But in the 1800s, there was more credibility given to a eyewitness account than there was any kind of graphical depiction, whether it be a photograph or whatever. Then you get to the 20th century when all of a sudden it's like, yeah, you could say whatever you want. I want to see the pictures. But then, you know, we had lots of fake UFO photos. We had the very famous photo of the dude with the giant, like, chicken or dachshund size grasshoppers. Did you ever see that hoax?
No.
Yeah, I'm sure Bryce can find it on there, but there is a brief period where, this isn't the photo I'm thinking of, but it's stuff like this, you know, where seeing was believing, And now we've entered, there we go, the second image right there, if you click on it, Bryce, that's the one I'm thinking of. We're entering this post-visual world where all of a sudden we can't trust our own eyes, or now all of a sudden the determinant of whether or not we think something's real or not is, hey man, is somebody making a buck on this? I'm only going to believe it if not.
And I wouldn't even use that. I think there's so many people who just do it for the lols that we've had the history of, you know, we've been faking photographs since photography was invented, and faked photographs have found their ways in the newspaper. You know, there's numerous examples with the Spanish-American Wars. Was that used to incite us into battle? Staged photographs, you know, that's one of the problematic things, is there's certain, we'll say, regimes in other countries that are very good at getting sympathy, and one of the things in which they do it is by, you know, well, we'll put a teddy bear in the site of an explosion, and, you know, people will cry, and people will think that a child died, but there was nobody there.
Well, and in fact, you see some of those, for example, the iconic photos of children, naked children running down the streets of Vietnam. That's not a case where it's so much faked, so much as artfully cropped after the fact, because it's a little bit, you know, when you look at that image, it is a gut punch to the horrors of war, but it has something taken away from it when you see the original photo as it was originally framed, where you see, you know, American GIs, other war photographers casually changing their film next to it. It's amazing how much of, I don't know where the ethical lines are and where things start to become manufactured and fake versus just artistically managed.
You know, that's a very good, it's a good question, because you get at any point where you choose to aim the lens in itself is a choice. You're absolutely making a choice to that. And we see numerous examples and counterexamples of that, of, you know, oh, here's the empty seats at this political rally. Well, that was, you know, 2 hours before they let people in. Or yes, but this was a rally that was originally scheduled for 500 people and 5,000 people showed up, so they had to move it to a different auditorium, you know. And these, I don't believe anything anybody ever says, anything at all. Even
especially us. Don't believe anything. So, okay. So what is the gold standard of evidence nowadays? Because if we live in a Photoshop world where all evidence can be faked and curated and cropped, and now, you know, we see astroturfing on social media, What is the gold standard for believability?
I don't know. You want to have enough, you know, I think it's the same as it always has been, is that, one, I'm a believer that you provisionally can accept things. You never want to say, well, this is 100% true, because that's the roadmap to deluding yourself, is mm-hmm. once you believe that, you know, reality is real. Our understanding of it can be imperfect. And when you think that you have a perfect understanding of an imperfect reality, then you're going to lead yourself into some very weird places. For me, it has to do a lot with, like, you know, what are our first person sources? What's the credibility for that? And as far as images and video, you look for, you want to see multiple sources of that, but you're never going to have 100%. You're never going to have 100%.
Sure. But nowadays, I think the biggest thing is, if an event happens, we instantly expect to see multiple angles from many different people at the same time. Whereas, you know, like, I mean, ever since in a post 9/11 world, we just expect that there's got to be cameras running at all angles, you know, if it's something important.
I agree, but I think that's the next step for hoaxing. I think the next step is, the next big hoax we're going to see is going to be like, hey, you know, remember when the Russian meteorite blew up? Okay,
sure.
And we had all of these, you know, there was handfuls of examples, and it was such an incredible thing. You know, there was a lot of skepticism at first, like, is this a real thing? Is this some sort of viral thing? And they've had it's happened with, like, I think, I don't know if it was Battle LA or Skyline or one of those other movies, these alien invasion movies, or, you know, where they, like, five different things get uploaded at once saying, look at this, look at this, look at this, which creates this idea of, hey, look what's going on. When they had the recent Trident missile test off the coast of California, you had a lot of different people making accounts for it. But before you saw the video, the photos looked different than what people were describing. But then once you saw the video of it, you go, wow, that's really compelling. It looked like something out of the War of the Worlds, like a searchlight stabbing out from the sky.
You know what? It's interesting. weirdly, I think we're looping back, I guess, to answer my own question. I think we're looping back to that 19th century paradigm where an eyewitness account does matter insofar as does it come from a trusted source? Like, let's say there's a UFO sighting or whatever. It's different. You know, if you just see a photo, we're so inured to the, you know, Photoshops of UFOs. But if we see, for example, let's say, you know, Greg Grunberg is a popular celebrity person. And if he says, guys, I am looking you right in the eye. I'm telling you, this is not a viral campaign. I am staking my online reputation on the fact that what you're seeing is exactly the way I saw it. I think that would have a tremendous amount of credibility and a tremendous amount of clout.
Like Russell Crowe's UFO video?
Oh, no, I didn't see this. What's his UFO video?
Russell Crowe, 2-3 years ago, said that he found that he was had video. He was shooting out a window, thought he was seeing like lights in the sky or whatever, and it was just it's a reflective phenomena. It was like car headlights reflecting off at an odd angle off of something. But he's like, hey, this is the real thing. We're seeing this thing here.
Well, so but it wasn't a fraud. He was just mistaken. It is all right.
He was mistaken. Yeah, he was sincere. He was absolutely sincere.
Wow, you can really tell that is definitely just a car passing by. When you know, with the burden of knowledge, the curse of knowing changes things a lot.
Yeah, so I agree that I think that the credibility of a person inherent credibility is certainly what is influential to that. One of the problems we have though in one of the ways in which people sort of fail to think critically is somebody will say, "Oh my gosh, you see this thing that's on CNN." And they'll send me some email that says CNN reported this blah blah blah. And it's not CNN. And I would get in discussions with people like about the Bible. They'd say, well, there were hundreds of witnesses when he came back. Like, no, somebody wrote and said – somebody wrote down that there were hundreds of witnesses. That's different than having 100 witness testimonials. Not to say that's not true or not.
Right.
That's where I fall on that. But people have this – a credible person told me this many credible people had that. And we get into these stupid internet memes that get thrown around like, oh, well, this great thing said by such and such person we all respect that's maybe borderline racist or whatever. That no, they didn't say that. You know, that never happened. Somebody just took this quote and put somebody else's name on it, and we just pass it on because our credibility filters get, you know, we see a keyword that, oh, I trust this, so it's okay. But that's not the source. That's not the source it came from.
Yeah, it's interesting. You could kind of mentally astroturf your way into credibility if I guess that CNN reports is the perfect phrase because you're not going to check to see if CNN actually reported it, but you do know that if they did, there's a heuristic that means, you know, it's very likely that there's some kind of credibility behind it.
Yeah, some responsible adults somewhere had to sign off on this or not, which was, you know, one of the problems, like the CNN, you know, iNews witness reporting or whatever was.
Oh yeah, by the way, that whole iNews, which again, I understand CNN's desire to help, what they want is the fastness of first reporter on the ground, you know, Twitter level reaction, but they want to maintain their credibility with the CNN brand. And unfortunately, I think the iReport thing really just did them harm and didn't really bring them much more rapid response. You know, they didn't get a better reputation for being fast on the draw for that kind of news.
Yeah, there have been a number of instances where people have tried like Wiki News and whatnot. And what happens is that the people who have the most reasoning or most effort to try to convince you of something, which are people who are arguing for a particular point of view, are the ones who are going to be the first ones to use that and abuse that and not give you full facts, not give you the full side of it. They're going to present it. They're going to use it as a platform for advocacy because they're like, it's like my Facebook feed. You know, my friends who put politics stuff on Facebook, stop. Don't do that. Don't subject your friends to your politics on Facebook because one, they probably have their own informed opinions. Two, it's not polite, you know. And three, you're becoming a shill for something that maybe you're not that informed about.
Yeah, boy, oh boy. There's a reason I post stuff on Facebook and virtually never read anything on there. It's amazing.
Yeah, and that becomes into this sort of, well, here's an opportunity for me to communicate to people. Like, well, yeah, you can, but it's not why maybe your friends wanted to talk to you there or whatever. And the same with these eyewitness, these sort of wiki journalism, these citizens journalism things. A lot of the people who are running to go do it are people with an agenda. Their agenda isn't the news. The agenda is truth as they see it. Now, they can't tell the difference because in their world, everybody knows this is a fact, but you know, that's not the case. Now, I don't mean to single out wiki news in particular. I meant kind of in general, the wiki sort of approach to like crowdsource stuff, because you know, who's going to volunteer to do this is going to be somebody who's very passionate about something.
Well, and it's funny because I would imagine that part of the reason wiki news is called that is partly to leverage the credibility of Wikipedia. Wikipedia, yes, anyone can edit it, yet anyone can change it. But over the years, it's built up this really good reputation. What's the story that it in a face-to-face test, it did about as well as the Encyclopedia Britannica, but the difference was the second the inaccuracies were reported in Wikipedia, they were able to instantly correct them, whereas Encyclopedia Britannica was not.
The problem with Wikipedia, though, is that you have certain areas they've had administrators that control certain topics that you cannot get other points of view in there. And there are numerous examples of, you know, there are certain people you will never see appear on there because they pissed off somebody who handles that topic at some point. You know, and that's the scary part of Wikipedia, is that it's not as transparent as we sort of think in many respects. And in fact, that there is it's only as good as the mods handling. On some subjects, the mods are fantastic. On some other ones who've been there for 15, 20 years, or at least as long as it's been around, are extremely territorial and vindictive. And I know people who are like, wow, you've done this, and you don't have this sort of, you don't have a Wikipedia page. Like, nope, it keeps getting taken down because this guy who's the mod got into an online argument with me back in such and such and won't allow
it. Wow. Wow. That's disappointing to find out. That's really interesting.
It's the way the cookie crumbles. There's the advantage, the disadvantage. You know, the advantage of Wikipedia is you get all these volunteers committing to it. The disadvantage is a sense of entitlement where they will sometimes, it's a small fraction. By and large, Wikipedia is my favorite resource. I go there all the time, particularly on certain kinds of concepts, because I'm pretty sure that I'm going to get the most intelligent. They have like some of their science stuff. They have wonderfully intelligent moderators handle these things. And I trust that. I trust that more than conventional science reporting. Because you have somebody who's a science reporter for some of these places, they know more than anybody else in the newsroom about science, but they don't know enough. And if any corrections or things that they get wrong, they're never going to hear from their editor because the editor doesn't know any difference.
Right. Well, and also it's like there's very little reason for any science writer on say Scientific American or any journal, there's very little reason for them to call out facts and figures that dispute their own thesis or their own position of the article. Whereas because Wikipedia is written by consensus of warring parties, it forces a more in-depth, kind of consensus or more nuanced evaluation of it.
Or there's going to be a talk back section. There's going to be people pointing this out, and somebody has to go there and look and see and say, oh, you know, why isn't this in here?
Right. Hey, man. So some folks are wondering what happened to Justin Young. We mentioned he wasn't feeling too hot to begin with. He bolted. But in the meantime, do you want to, Andrew, go into picks? Do you have picks?
Let's go into picks. I need to think of my pick.
That's okay. I've got a great pick. I'm really, really excited about it. We have talked before about, in the 1960s, there was a book called The Population Bomb by Paul Ehrlich. And he projected famine around the corner. He projected that per Malthusian economics, there's only so much food in the world. And he went on The Tonight Show 20 plus times. He was a funny, very likable, charismatic, entertaining character, even though he was a lot like Carl Sagan, even though he was projecting a kind of a horrifying message of doom and gloom, he did so in a way that was exciting and relatable to the masses. And as a result, a lot of his philosophies and his organizations have created a lot of policies that still affect, you know, environmental science to this very
created
day.
Human misery. Let's just put it flat out.
It's fine. But on the flip side, we've talked about the economist Julian Simon, who was not as well liked, who was not as popular, who was in a quiet university, and I want to say Champaign, Urbana, Illinois, and was fuming, raging at the proclamations. He says, humans are not butterflies. You know, yes, if you overpopulate with butterflies, you have a population collapse. But humans, you get 100 humans in the room, you figure out ways to create more. And he made the counterintuitive claim that essentially human intelligence would guarantee that we never run out of anything. Like, as we start to run out of something, we will find substitutions, we'll find better technologies to get more of it, we'll figure out ways to not need it, but that we, and to some degree, he's 100% right. We've never run out of a non-renewable resource. Or at least that's the quote I've read somewhere. Don't hold me to it. But here's the interesting part. He did not have the leverage or the platform. So in order to reach out and to say something that would get the attention of Ehrlich, he said, hey, man, you want to bet? He said, if you're so sure that everything's going to run out, what say we make a bet on 10 commodities? And I think he said you could choose oil if you wanted, but it was like tungsten, tin, nickel, and a bunch of other stuff. And let's take the 10-year totals. And if you're right and everything's running out, all of these should be much more expensive in 10 years. Why don't we make a bet and see who wins? And he won the bet, but that bet is the stuff of legends. And that is my pick. Is the book is called The Bet. It's available on Audible right now. It's like a 7-hour audiobook. And the purpose of the book is to humanize all of the players in the bet, to tell the background before it. And it does a really good job of making an argument for why as satisfying is as it is to have these polar opposite viewpoints and to have one side sticking in the face of another. The author's position is that maybe that's not the best way to run environmental policy, like a sports game. And it was fascinating to read because I was largely familiar with the Julian Simon side of things, but it did a good job of portraying both men as very flawed and very human individuals. He portrays Julian Simon as somebody who battled depression most of his life, who didn't really get the validation that he thought he deserved, and was very swept up in all of a sudden, you know, the conservatives in the early 1980s in the Reagan era, you know, all of a sudden they had a champion and somebody whose work they could point to validate their growth supply side economics theories. It was really interesting because I was left a little bit more bummed out about both Ehrlich and Simon by the time it ended. I didn't expect that. I liked Simon a little bit less. I liked Ehrlich a lot less. Like, every cartoon stereotype of the wealthy, jet-setting, like, talks about times he's in Aspen, Colorado, sipping wine on the top of a mountaintop at a ski lodge with his friends, talking about the need to eliminate 1 billion people from the planet and what kind of policies they can enact and how they can hold back foreign aid and insist it be tied together with population control measures and birth control and so on. I don't know. It was really a fascinating read. If you like that whole story, it's definitely worth reading. That's my pick. The Bet by Paul Sabin. S-A-B-I-N.
There's also, I'm guessing, there's also a Planet Money episode about this.
Well, they have the author on there, and he briefly talks about it, and that's what put it on my radar. But definitely worth reading the entire book for.
Very cool.
It's what's interesting is that right now we have an amazing economic phenomenon taking place that's not getting nearly as much attention as it probably should in helping us understand the predictive or lack of predictive quality of certain sectors of, you know, the chattering classes about these things. Gas prices are as low, you know, they're in some places, you know, they're $1.25, $1.26 in parts of this country. Gas prices are ridiculously low. They're historic low. Gas prices, if you compare to, let's say, the height of the gas price, you know, in, you know, we're at what you could buy a gallon of gas for like in 1980, you know, in some parts of the country. Same now, of course, adjusted for inflation, whatever, ridiculously cheap. Almost nobody, when I say almost nobody, there were a contingent of economists who said, no, this is, we think this is where things are going to go because peak oil, it was this concept that's been batted around for over 100 years that we're going to reach this point at which we're not going to have any more oil. But people who were geologists were saying, well, no, actually there's more, but yeah, it'll be too expensive to reach. And it's like this Malthusian thing. Well, but yeah, but technology will progress. Ah, it won't progress that much. No, we think it will. And we're, peak oil is not a term that you really hear talked about other than some of the most diehard people are saying, well, we're still going to reach it. Like, no, we're not. The amount of oil reserves we have is ridiculous. Our access to more oil is tremendous. And even if we reach the point of we use that, we've got these things, these, you know, methane hydrates, which far exceed our amount of oil. And but it's weird because it's just the number of people that we've been hearing talking about for years and years about peak oil are wrong, flat out wrong, absolutely absurdly wrong. Yet, you know, there's, you, they don't get called to the task on that.
Sure. Well, and by the way, Strengths in the chat says, well, Easter Island ran out of trees. That's my whole point, is we run out of renewable resources all the time. Because we treat them like, they'll come back, there'll be more trees, and then we just chop them all down, and then we have none. It's the non-renewable resources that counterintuitively, the prices start to reflect the actual scarcity of them, and as a result, we don't seem to run out of them. Don't quote me. I don't know nothing. I'm just quoting other people.
Easter Island ran out of trees because they dedicated their economy to a ridiculous religious belief that they needed to keep erecting these monuments and tearing down their trees to move them across there. It was, they decided they were going to embrace some ridiculous form of inefficiency because they thought this would please the gods. And I would say that there's an argument to be made that a lot of our I am very much for reducing our use of carbon, reducing the number of our pollutants, reducing all these sorts of things. But there is this sort of idea that, like, yeah, but if we make this sacrifice, which one won't make a difference until the latter part of the century, it will not make a difference as far as reducing these things in any miserable thing. It will dramatically impede our economy and send us down the path of Easter Island, where we progressively become poorer and poorer and poorer. So. Yeah, they did. You know, you compare Haiti to the Dominican Republic. They share the island, and Dominicans had some bad governance of late, but up until a reasonable time, it was a stark difference economy-wise, because in Haiti, they had no real property rights. They could tear down all the trees without penalty because nobody owned the trees, so they had no trees. They had erosion, and it just, one of the many things that just devastated that economy of you know, an amazing group of people that when they immigrate to other places like the United States become extremely successful, which, you know, shows you that it's bad management, you know, in my opinion.
Yeah, absolutely. So. What about you, man? What do you got to recommend?
Oh, let me just put out something else just to think about with oil. With the reduction in oil prices, by the way, that means that $2 trillion in the last 3 or 4 years that we did not spend on oil got to go to other parts of the economy. Think about that. $2 trillion that would have gone to oil companies, et cetera, because of the reduced costs, got to be spent on other factors. And that's an amazing thing to think about. Every time oil prices get low, it means you get to use that money somewhere else.
Yeah, absolutely.
So my pick, man, you know, I've picked this before and I'm gonna pick it again because every time I sit down and watch it, I absolutely adore it and I love it. Actually, I'm gonna do two picks. One is just Galaxy Quest is on Netflix. We lost
so
Alan Rickman.
So good.
It's a perfect little movie. It really, really is. It's so good. I highly recommend you just go watch Galaxy Quest again. And what's his face? The lead Thermion, you know, you'll recognize him from Deadpool, by the way.
Yeah, that's right.
you know, Rainn Wilson's in it briefly. You just go look at all the other cameos in there. But one, check that out. And then I watched a few and I enjoyed it. And then I got back into watching a few. And sometimes I start off watching an episode and maybe I get a little bit bored and I have to come back into it. And then I enjoy it thoroughly. I'm talking about Black Mirror.
Oh, my gosh. So good.
I haven't finished all of the way into it, but just started the one where some sort of weird future thing where some girl's being hunted by people with guns and stuff, which, you know, like the prime minister one, like the pig thing was one like, you know, meh. And then the one about the reality competition show Hot Shot, I thought was fantastic. The Domhnall Gleeson one I thought was great. And I think that so many of them are really, really, really good. So that's my other pick. And then, you know, check out my book, Station Breaker, please.
Heck yeah, dude. Station Breaker. And of course, the news behind the scenes is Black Mirror has picked up for a number of episodes with Netflix, and they've already started to announce some of the stars that are going to be on there. It's really going to be a powerhouse brand very shortly.
Yeah, absolutely. Brian, it's been weird.
Yeah, it has.
The Diamond Club hopes you have enjoyed this program.